My name is Brian Ventrudo, publisher of CosmicPursuits.com. My guest today is astronomy author, photographer, and teacher Alan Dyer, who is the co-author, along with Terence Dickinson, of perhaps the Bible of hands-on amateur astronomy called The Backyard Astronomer's Guide. And most recently, the author of Nightscapes and Time Lapses, a full guide on how to create nightscape images and combine them into video time lapses to show the motion and changes in the night sky and foreground landscape. And we're here today to talk about the basics of nightscape imaging and how to take your own dramatic images of the Earth and the night sky. Welcome, Alan. It's great to have you here today.
Hi, Brian. Pleased to be with you.
So let's talk about nightscapes. I've finished your excellent ebook on the subject, and it's really more than an ebook. It's a full course in nightscape imaging and time lapses. Now, I've been a stargazer for a long time, but very few pages went by as I read your book where I did not learn something new and useful about imaging. So let's start at the beginning, because nightscape imaging is a fairly new art form, and many listeners are likely beginners. So how do you define a nightscape or a nightscape image?
Well, a nightscape image is really a form of astrophotography, but one that's become hugely popular in the last few years because the cameras are finally able to do good nightscape photography. It's a kind of photography I struggled with, and most people never even attempted with film cameras, you know. But starting really 10 years ago with the advent of digital cameras, and particularly DSLR cameras, digital single-lens reflex cameras, this is sort of a high-end of digital cameras, although for $500 or $600 you can get a very good DSLR camera. That's what makes it possible, because they're just much more sensitive. They pick up more information, especially in the dark shadows and in dark night-type photographs, and that's what nightscapes are. They're pictures of the earthly landscape at locations where you might well take normal daytime landscape pictures, picture postcard shots, but you go back at night and you take shots with the landscape now illuminated by nothing but moonlight, or in some cases with no moon, just by starlight. The cameras are that sensitive that they can get a great image of the landscape with nothing but starlight as the source of illumination. And yet in the sky, you now have the stars or the Milky Way. And so it just puts the landscape literally in a whole new light and just makes a very stunning image with the same scene that might be very familiar to people by day. Now it's got stars in the sky and the Milky Way and the sky might be blue even, because moonlight lighting the landscape will also light up the sky blue. So almost it sometimes almost might look like a daytime shot, and yet there's stars in the sky. So that's the essence of nightscapes. It's something that astrophotographers, very experienced with shooting all kinds of objects in the sky, are getting more and more interested in, but also regular landscape photographers who never thought to go out and put all their cameras away once it got dark, now realizing, hey, wait a minute, I can do stuff at night as well, and with the techniques that they may be familiar with in doing landscape photography, but the exposures are so much longer at night.
Right, right. So it's different from astrophotography in the sense that you're not shooting only a celestial object through a telescope.
The nightscape always will include some kind of earthly landscape below. So it's a combination of the sky, the stars, the night sky, with a landscape below, to put it into context. And for the most part, you're usually just using a camera that's on a tripod. It's not tracking the sky, although you can do that as well, and I certainly do that, but you don't have to. You don't have to have any fancy telescope gear or tracking gear, just a camera on a tripod, and that's why it's quite attractive to people starting out. And indeed, you could spend a lifetime doing nothing but that and get great shots.
Right, right. I mean, I've been following your site for some time now. I don't see you shooting a lot through a telescope these days. Is this your new passion? I mean, it's an art form, really, something you can devote a lot of time to, I suppose.
You certainly can, and because of the book that I published a few months ago and the work necessary to prepare that and get examples and the like for that, I spent a lot of the last year or two doing this kind of photography with fairly simple gear and not doing a lot of the, what we call prime focus photography through a telescope, although I still do that a fair amount, but uh, But that involves, you know, fancy tracking gear and guiders and all that, and that's not what this is about at all, to get shots, close-ups of galaxies and nebulas and beautiful shots, but that's a whole different type of astrophotography. It's what a lot of people get into the hobby to do, but they find that it can be quite demanding. You need really good skies and very dark sights, and you need a dark night as well with no moon to do that kind of photography, whereas the nightscape photography actually positively benefits from having the moon there, and even some clouds in the sky can make the add to the shot as well, certainly in time-lapse photography with the clouds moving. So the conditions are less demanding, and you get to go to some neat places and as well. So it combines travel with your photography interest, if you already have an interest in landscape photography.
Yeah, I found too that in my own attempts at both types of photography, that in nightscaping you're actually not staring at a computer screen all night or trying to guide on some faint star. You're actually getting to enjoy the night sky as you shoot. Also, another advantage.
You certainly can. Again, if you're just taking short exposures, you can be set up and done and taken a few shots in just a few minutes, really. But if you do want to do long time-lapse movies, then that requires shooting exposures. Each exposure is quite short, but nevertheless, you're doing several hundred of them, perhaps, in order to turn and string into a movie. And that may take an hour or 2 hours of shooting. So you still need to be prepared to spend some time at a site or location and not just rush up, set up the camera, grab a few snapshots, and disappear and head on to the next location. You can do that, but the time-lapse photography in particular, or star trails where the stars are recorded moving across the sky on a single frame as streaks over an hour or 2 hours, well, it takes that long to acquire all the frames to produce that star trail. So it can be a type of photography that's not as demanding on equipment, but still can be demanding on your time.
Okay, so you're not just sitting back and having a bourbon while the camera does all the work.
Well, the camera is doing all the work in a sense, in that you set it up with a device called an intervalometer. If you're doing time-lapse or star trails where you need to take hundreds of frames, you're not firing the frame every few seconds. That would be silly. There's very simple devices, no more than a $50 or $60 device that plugs into your camera, and it fires the shutter for you automatically at settings you set in terms of how long each exposure is and how long between each exposure. But once you start it going with the exposures that you determine, you can sit back and enjoy the sky, do some stargazing with your telescope or naked eye or binoculars, or just have a sleep back in your car or whatever while the camera's doing the work. So in that sense, it is much, much easier.
Okay, very cool, very cool. Well, speaking of equipment, let's get into that. So you mentioned in your book what's required, but let's just go through the basics. So obviously you need a camera, and you recommend a DSLR.
Yeah, that's the best quality of camera with the largest sensor and the lowest noise, and that's a concern when you're shooting at night. Long exposures add noise. You're shooting quite dark subjects, so very small point-and-shoot cameras, the kind you might use in your pocket or something just for snapshots, aren't going to work very well for long nighttime exposures. There's other kinds of cameras that have sensors almost as good as what's in a DSLR, using called mirrorless cameras, compact system cameras, and the image quality is as good as what's in a DSLR, but they're much more compact cameras. I've not used one of those for this kind of photography. They should work fine. There's a couple of caveats in that the lens selection for those cameras is limited. They require a special kind of lens to focus properly on that sort of smaller camera body. And there's no optical viewfinder to look through to help frame your subject at night. You have to have the electronic viewfinder, and I've certainly found at workshops that I've done where people have those cameras, they're having difficulty just aiming and framing the scene because they can't see anything. So they have to take a shot and just kind of trial and error figure out whether it's focused or framed properly. So it, in theory, should be possible, but it's not a kind of camera I've used myself, so I can't recommend it per se, and I know there's a couple of drawbacks. That's why in my book, and certainly all the professional nightscape and time-lapse photographers are pretty well using DSLR cameras. And you know, again, a good one doesn't need to cost you more than $600 or $700. You can certainly spend a $2,000 or $3,000 if you wish, but you don't need to spend a lot of money.
Yeah, I noticed you and a lot of other nightscapers use a Canon 6D, for example, which is $1,500 or $2,000 roughly, I suppose. But you also recommend some crop frame cameras. I was happy to see that mine just barely made the list too. So I was very excited about that. And you're right. You know, I've got a camera that is $600 or $700 for the body, so that's enough to get you started. Now, of course, you need lenses. Now, most cameras come with a kit lens. Can you get anywhere with those, or do you need to get something more specialized?
Well, the kit lens, the sort of 18 to 55 zoom or whatever, that's a good all-purpose lens, is great for daytime stuff, and it's good for bright scenes, twilight scenes, or very bright moonlit scenes, perhaps, where you have a fair amount of light, even at night. But once it gets fairly dark, those types of lenses, the kit zooms, are a little too slow. The f-stop, the f-ratio, they're f4, f5.6. They're not letting in enough light to really get good shots. And so I certainly advise people that if you can certainly start with that. By all means, start with that, see what you get. And if you find yourself hooked and you want to get better shots, your best investment will be a new lens, and better to get what's called a prime lens. It's just a fixed focal length, not a zoom, and typically a 20 or 24 millimeter wide angle, and pretty fast, f2 or f2.8, no slower than f2.8. Again, a camera store will advise you on lenses for your particular camera, but that's what you want, something like a 20 or 24 millimeter f2.8, if not faster, lens. And they can be a little pricey, but it is an investment that's worth it if you really want to get into it. You need that speed where it's letting in more light for a given exposure time, and you're going to be able to pick up more stars and the Milky Way itself.
Right, right. Now, I guess the advantage, too, is that you don't really need to autofocus at night necessarily, so you can use manual focus lens. I've seen some good ones from Rokinon, for example, that are recommended, and the price is not too crazy at all.
That's a very good point, in that there are these manual lenses that you can get through online retailers. Your local camera store might have them, but they don't have any of the fancy functions, autofocus and the like, auto exposure, and you don't need them at night because you are focusing manually. So Rokinon is a brand name. Samyang is another one. Although I think it's Rokinon is the name that they're sold in mostly in North America, and you can get a nice 24 millimeter. A 14 millimeter is a favorite of mine that I have in the Rokinon brand name. It's quite wide angle, but it's very useful for a lot of nightscape photography, and it's f2.8. The optical quality is excellent. And it's about $350, something like that. I can't remember now. But certainly in the $300 to $400 range, quite fast, quite wide-angle lens, which if you were to buy in a fancy auto this and auto that version, it might cost $1,000 or $2,000 even. So this is the one advantage to nightscape photography. We are demanding of the lens quality and the optics and the speed, but we don't need any of the fancy auto focus and auto exposure and all that, all those functions.
Okay, okay. So, so camera and lens. Now, you've mentioned an intervalometer or a remote release, so you don't need to touch the camera. Possibly, I guess you could use a timer if you're in a pinch for a simple image. Now, every nightscape site I read, and your book was no exception, emphasizes a tripod. Do not skimp on a tripod.
Absolutely. That's the other component that's essential, because you're taking long exposure, so the camera has to be held very steady, even for a second or 2 second exposure, let alone 30 or 40 seconds or a minute, as you typically might do. So it needs to be a good tripod, and just a little flimsy travel tripod that, you know, you might take for trips or whatever, it generally isn't going to be sufficient. You need something that's fairly sturdy. You don't have to spend a ton of money. You don't need a huge tripod, because you do have to carry it different places, so you don't want something that's too hefty. But it needs to be pretty solid. So $100 to $200 will get you a fairly good tripod, I think. That'll be fairly lightweight. but also quite sturdy because that camera can't move at all during long, long exposures, especially for time-lapse sequences where the camera cannot move. You'll see that vibration or that movement in jitter in the final movie if that happens.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I guess if you scrimp on a tripod, you end up paying for it in time by needing to shoot over, or maybe not being able to shoot at all if you're getting vibration.
Oh, it can certainly ruin your shots entirely if it collapses or sinks or gets blown around in the wind or whatever. You need a pretty good one. And there's lots on the market now. Again, just go into your local camera store, say what it is you're looking for, and just shop around, and you'll find something that's a good compromise, good balance between price, weight, and sturdiness as well.
Okay. Well, let's move on to locations now. This is something that fascinates me. I see a lot of nightscape images are shot from the same sorts of places, especially national parks in the U.S. and Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. Do you need to travel to exotic locations, or what's the drive to do that?
You don't certainly need to go to exotic locations costing, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and great air travel and all that, although if you're at exotic locations, by all means go to it with nightscape photography. But you often need to go to some location that's fairly scenic. It doesn't need to be spectacular by any means. Lots of people I know who, you know, live on the prairies as I do, and I do as well, we just find old barns and buildings like that and just riverscapes, things like that on the prairies here, just a nice kind of picturesque scene. So we're certainly not going to something spectacular, but you need to go to a spot that's got an interesting foreground, as well as having the sky in the background. So it takes a little scouting out during the day, perhaps, and that's part of the fun. Part of the planning is finding some suitable spots where you might encounter a spot by day, and you think, oh, I got to make a note of that. I often take some iPhone shots of that location that will kind of tag it for me, and I can find it again or whatever and go back and go back at night and shoot it under the light of the moon or stars or whatever. But any kind of scenic spots, provincial or national parks, conservation areas, whatever, a nice pond or a lake where the sky will be beautifully reflected in the pond or lake, but, you know, as much as possible natural landscapes, although you can certainly do cityscapes, you know, twilight scenes and things over city skylines as well, but if you want to get the stars in the Milky Way showing up, you have to go to dark sky locations, and that's 50 or 60 miles out of a urban location, perhaps.
Okay, so urban stargazers are not totally lost. There is some opportunity to shoot in the city or near a city, too, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just the other night, I left my rural home to head into the city to get to a location overlooking the Calgary skyline of the full moon rising. And so that made a neat shot, you know. So things like moonrises, moonsets, and planets in conjunction, as we'll have over the next month or two as Venus and Jupiter come close together here, speaking in spring 2015. Things like that, bright objects like that, or just a crescent moon next to a bright planet, those are great from city urban locations. But even so, you want a nice spot overlooking a picturesque skyline, the river valley, or whatever it might be that's going to make scenically in the foreground an interesting shot as well as having the sky there.
Right, right. So a lot of nightscapes, of course, include the Milky Way near Sagittarius, the constellation Sagittarius and Scorpius. But I notice, as you just mentioned, you do a lot of work with moonlight, so you don't waste the days of the full moon or near full moon. So what's the approach with moonlight images, and is that the best place for a beginner to start as far as nightscapes go?
Well, I certainly suggest that in that moonlit nights, especially around full moon, or certainly any time kind of first quarter moon to full to last quarter moon. The last quarter moon isn't going to rise till quite late, so it'd be a little more demanding of your time. But during the waxing phases of the moon, from sort of crescent to full, when the moon is in the evening sky, once it gets dark, meaning the sun is set and twilight is over, you have the moon in the sky. The moon is your source of illumination, and so you can use it to light the landscapes just as the sun would during the day. In fact, the quality of the light from the moon is very similar to what the sun provides. It's just much, much fainter. So your exposures are typically 10 to 40 seconds at f2.8, maybe f4. Maybe you can use a little slower lens in that case because the moonlight can be fairly bright. And your ISO speed is the other third factor that you can use to set exposures by. That's how fast the camera sensor is, or how sensitive it is, that you adjust with the ISO number. And during the day, you'd use ISO 100 or 200, but at night, you're at least ISO 400, if not 800 to 3200 even. But on a moonlit night, typically ISO 800 to 1600, so you know, fairly fast, fairly sensitive on the ISO speed, and 10 to 40 seconds on the exposure. Do that, go out to a nice location, set up, and I can't say exactly what the exposure would be, but that's the beautiful thing of digital cameras. You just give it a try at what you think might be best and have a look and see if it's too bright, too dark, and adjust from there. You'll be amazed at what the camera picks up that your eye is sort of barely seeing at night, even if you're nicely dark adapted. Suddenly the scene lights up and it looks like daytime, except there's stars in the sky. And it's just magical. And because moonlight is sunlight, it's just much fainter. It's just the moon reflecting the sunlight back to us. So the scene looks like it was shot in the daytime if you give it enough exposure, and yet there's stars in the sky over this otherwise familiar-looking landscape.
Right, right. So you mentioned exposure. So you're looking at several seconds here, if not tens of seconds, and higher ISO and wide-open aperture. You mentioned something in the book called exposed to the right, and this is a key thing for nightscape imagers, something you may not necessarily do in daytime photography. Can you explain just briefly what exposed to the right is?
Yes. The major mistake that I find with nightscape photos that people take, especially when they're starting out, is they're too dark. They're simply too dark. They haven't given it enough exposure. Sometimes it's just being afraid to, or often it's being afraid to give it more exposure, thinking that if they do, the noise level will go up. When you're shooting at night under dark scenes, it's always noise that's going to be the concern. It's not during the daytime, but at night it is. And noise goes up as that ISO number goes up. It goes up if you increase the exposure time as well. But the worst thing is to underexpose, create a very dark scene, either on purpose in some cases, people do that, thinking they'll fix it later in Photoshop. And you can. You can brighten the scene, but what will happen is the noise will actually start to get worse. It's far, far better to record an original picture with enough signal to begin with that's properly exposed, even overexposed a little bit. And that's what we mean by exposed to the right. Most cameras and all processing software have what's called a histogram, a little graph of the number of pixels versus how bright or dark the pixels are. And if it's slammed to the left saying that all the pixels are very dark, that's not good. You want that histogram to be kind of a mountain range with a rising from the left and peaking somewhere in the lower part or the middle part and then tailing off. And so it's shifted to the right, which is what we mean by ETTR, exposed to the right. Don't be afraid to give your camera signal. Don't be afraid to make the exposure longer, open up the aperture, or even increase the ISO speed if that's what it takes to get a well-exposed picture. That's what you want, well-exposed in the camera, and then you've got more signal to play with when you're processing. Don't expect to be able to fix it all later in Photoshop or whatever. You might be able to, but the picture might end up looking really noisy if you do that.
So you want to get the data right in the camera if possible, rather than trying to tease it out later.
Absolutely. You've got to get a good, well-exposed and well-focused as well. Again, taking the time to focus if you need to manually focus your lens. All cameras have what's called live focus, where you can aim it at a bright star or planet or something and zoom in on it with the live view mode and then manually focus the lens, something you may need to do even with the manual low-cost lenses that we were speaking about. Sometimes you can just slide them over to the infinity mark and they're sharply focused. That's great. You want to check that that's the case. But any lens that's got an autofocus mechanism, generally you need to manually focus it, turn it off auto, manually focus it so that the stars are as sharp as possible. So focus and exposure, the two most sort of critical mistakes people make and why pictures often look bad, is they are fuzzy or they're just too dark and dim and not well exposed.
Yeah, live view is a godsend for focusing. My first DSLRs didn't have that, and it was quite a chore to get them to get it right. It was almost trial and error, really.
It really was, and almost any camera made in the last 5 or 6 years has got live focus. So if yours doesn't, it's probably quite an older model. Not to say you can't go ahead and use it, by all means do, but as you say, yeah, focusing was a bit of a trial and error. You take a picture and see if it was sharp, zoom in on, no, take another one, refocus and try it again. You could do it, but it was a bit frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. Now, so we want to get the data right in the camera, and we want to keep the data. So you do mention in your book the file formats, and you recommend, in fact, you demand that you really must save your photos in RAW format.
Absolutely. All digital cameras, certainly DSLRs and the better quality cameras, have the option of saving the file that you take as either RAW or a JPEG, which is a compressed mode, or maybe both. But for any kind of nightscape photography, any kind of demanding photography, you should use the RAW mode. JPEGs are really only good for if you're taking lots and lots of pictures, snapshots during the day, and you're concerned about shooting lots, then filling up a card or whatever, and you're not going to be near your computer for a while. That's fine for daytime snapshots and casual things, but for serious nightscape photography, which will require processing afterwards, you want to shoot raw. That way you're recording the maximum amount of detail and information that the camera sensor is capable of recording, and so you've got the maximum amount of data to work with to feed into your Photoshop or whatever image processing, Lightroom, whatever you're using. You can then extract more detail from the shadows, and that's how you can pick up detail in the shadows lit only by starlight. You will have a tough time doing that with JPEGs. The JPEGs throw away all kinds of information, about half the information, right in the camera that you'll never be able to recover later on in processing, where it's all there for you with the RAW mode. The files are bigger, but it's worth it. And these days, memory cards and computer hard drives and everything are pretty low cost, so it's not the concern that it was a few years ago in terms of storage space and file size.
Right, right. Now, some people are turned off RAW because when they preview them in their camera, they look kind of funny, not much color or whatnot. So to get the detail out of a RAW file, you need to process it. And I would imagine something like iPhoto or something very simple don't handle raw files. So what sort of processing software do you need to get started? I mean, do you need to spend $700 on Photoshop on day one? Or
you certainly don't. And almost any modern, up-to-date image processing program will be able to handle raw files. Now, if you haven't updated your computer software, your image processing software, for a while, it's possible if you've got a brand new camera, its raw format, and they change from camera to camera, won't be read by some older software that you have. You try to open it, and it says, I can't read this file. You'll get a message or something. But almost Microsoft and Apple, I mean, Apple just a few days ago updated their operating system to read the raw files from a new batch of cameras. So even iPhoto should work, but the adjustments may be fairly limited. But definitely you need generally a better quality image processing program to work with the raw files to really extract the most information, reduce the noise, and recover detail in the highlights and shadows. Something like Photoshop Elements, it's about $120, is certainly good to start with. Or the one I like, that I can recommend, is Lightroom. Photoshop Lightroom, which you can buy outright for, again, I think it's around $150 or
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah.
Very capable program for raw processing. In fact, its raw processing side, the develop module, is as sophisticated as it gets. It's the same as what you'll get with very expensive latest model Photoshop. It's very capable. What Lightroom can't do is complex layering and masking and develop, creating images out of layers and layers of images, which sometimes you might want to do with the more advanced kind of processing. But otherwise, Lightroom or Photoshop Elements, and there's quite a few other low-cost image processing programs that you don't have to spend more than even $50 or $60 on, and that will get you started anyway. It just won't have the more advanced features of something like Photoshop.
Okay. Now, this is a little more advanced, and probably we won't spend too much time on this, but a lot of people want to take their nightscapes and combine them into time lapses. And you spend a fair bit of time in your book on how to make time lapses, not just static ones, but ones that have some dramatic motion in them. But what's the first step once you get the details down and making a good nightscape? What's the first step to start making a time lapse? Maybe what's a good first starter project, for example?
Well, if you go out to a nice scenic spot and on a moonlit night and get some good still shots, well exposed, well focused, you've got to have those fundamentals down. And if you have an intervalometer device, and again, $50 or $60 will get you one that will fire the camera shutter automatically at the exposure setting that you've determined, 30 seconds, whatever it might be, and you set the lens, you focused it, and the like, and now you can set it up so that it takes a series of those shots. Every couple of seconds, it fires the shutter again, does the long exposure. As soon as it's finished, bang, it fires it again. It continues to fire for 100 shots, 200, 300 is for a time-lapse movie. It's kind of the typical number I aim for. And you sit back while it does that. And it might take an hour or 2 hours to accumulate all the right number of frames. And you now have several hundred frames that you can process. And again, a program like Lightroom will allow you to process lots of frames very easily. You just process one, and you can copy the settings from the one frame to all the others. Bing! You've now got 300 frames all processed very, very quickly. And then you can use something like Lightroom to export them all into JPEGs, into smaller JPEGs. That's typically what you need in order to turn them into a movie, not from the raw files directly themselves. And there's all kinds of even free programs that will take a folder of JPEGs and bring them into a movie very quickly. One-click time-lapse assembler is one I know of on the Mac, and there's all kinds of free programs for Windows or Mac, and it'll simply, in seconds, string that into a little QuickTime movie or Windows Media format movie running at whatever frame rate you want, so many frames per second. So all your frames are suddenly playing back in quick succession, and you now see motion. You now see the stars moving. And once you produce one or two of these, you're addicted. It's quite amazing. I mean, even if you take those shots and just scroll through them in your camera, as you're playing them back with your little thumb wheel, scrolling through them, that's how everybody first discovers it. Look at that! It's moving. Right. Wait a minute. How can I do that? Well, it's fairly simple. Actually, and the software is not, in some cases, maybe free to actually string the files into a movie. But you do generally have to turn all your processed raw images into a folder of smaller JPEGs, sort of HD movie size, 1,900 pixels, whatever, 1920 by 1080 is kind of your HD movie size. You don't want to be creating a movie with 5,000 by 4,000 pixels, which is what your camera can produce. But that's a tough movie to play back on most systems, a movie with that many pixels in each of its frames.
Right. And then you can add music too, I suppose, and all that, right, as you
see. Oh, absolutely. Once you've captured enough of these, and as I say, it might take an evening or a few hours of shooting just to grab enough frames to make 30 seconds, 40 seconds, of playback value. If you shoot 300 frames, typically we kind of play those back at 30 frames per second. It's sort of a typical playback rate well, 300 frames can last 10 seconds in your final sort of movie. So if you want to make a little music video of some kind, and you figure out, well, how many, you know, clips, how many individual clips do I need to make a little movie of? Even a couple of minutes worth is going to take, you know, maybe a dozen clips. So you're out shooting for a number of nights to get enough clips together to make into a little music video of some kind. But that's the fun part, and so you need now to, you know how to edit movie clips together to make a little final movie out of them.
Right, right. Yeah, so, I mean, this is a true art form. You're like a cinematographer in the dark.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, that's the fun stuff, is that you learn all kinds of new skills and techniques, and you produce a product that's really quite unique as well. And it's why a lot of people that are not being interested in astrophotography before, because so much of it is quite technically oriented, if you want to shoot close-ups of galaxies and the like. And with that, you produce a shot of the Orion Nebula or the Andromeda Galaxy that everybody else has shot.
Yes.
Whereas the time-lapse stuff is unique. No one else has that shot, that scene, taken that night at wherever you happen to have been, let alone the sequence of things that you may have produced to make a movie. It's totally unique to you, where you were, your location, your style, you know, the music you pick, whatever. Although a word about that, if you're going to publish something on the web, you shouldn't really use music that you've taken off, you know, CDs or whatever. You don't have the rights to do that. It's YouTube and others will take you down, or, you know, someone will object if you don't have the rights to it. So typically a lot of people will, their sources are royalty-free music. You may pay a little bit for the music, but you now have the rights to publish it and put it on the web. Those rights were granted to you when you paid the few dollars for that particular clip of music.
Right, right. Understood. So I've got just a couple other questions left for you here. I guess I've been living in a city too long, but I get the same question from a lot of my readers too. But how do you spend so much time alone in the dark? I mean, you know, 100 miles from the nearest town. Is it a challenge? Are there any tips you recommend for safety? Or?
Well, certainly I and any, again, more into time-lapse photography, which is very demanding of time because of all the length of time you have to shoot to get enough frames to make into a movie. You spend a lot of time at a dark, kind of lonely sites. In some respects, it's sort of the attraction. You know, I've been to places like the Columbia Ice Fields and Lake Louise and Banff and Jasper and places like that, but that by day are thronged with thousands of people. And you go back at night, and there's nobody there. You know, you have the place to yourself, and yet the scene before your eyes, lit by the moon or with the Milky Way there, is stunning. And everybody else is ignoring it. And it's this incredibly different view of these locations. And it's quite magical. That's one of the attractions. But it's a little lonely, and if you're in down the long pathway at the end of, you know, through the woods or something, you think, oh, it's dark, you know, the bears, whatever. and you're kind of concerned about that as well, and who knows I'm here, and what if something were to happen? A couple of years ago, shooting at Bow Lake in Banff, and I was staying at the lodge there on the lakeshore, Numtaija Lodge. It's a great, beautiful, historic log cabin, wonderful spot to stay. But I wanted to stay right there and not have to drive a great distance when I was finished at night, which was wonderful. But even to take the shots, I had to walk a few hundred feet down the lakeshore to set up and get the shot. Well, that afternoon, there was a grizzly bear wandering around the yard at the lodge,
The
local, you know, park warden came along with the paintball gun and you know, blasted it and made noise, scares the bear away. But, you know, wait a minute, I'm now out there at night shooting, wandering back and forth, and there was a grizzly here just 3 or 4 hours before. I hope he's gone away, because if I suddenly encounter him, there's nobody else around. I'm out there at 2 a.m. by myself. So it's always a concern, and that's why I certainly do like to kind of set up not far from your car or where you're sleeping or staying or whatever and do that. But more adventuresome people, you know, wander far afield at night, and then have to hike back a long way in the middle of the night with their cameras. I tend to be not quite as ambitious as that, but anyway, it's part of the fun, part of the adventure. But yeah, it's one of the concerns you have to keep in mind is who knows you're there and what could happen if something goes wrong, and you know, who do you contact, what do you do?
Yeah, I've heard of some nightscape imagers in Western North America, especially maybe carrying some bear spray with them or whatnot, and always, you know, letting someone know where they are. But
I think it's probably a very good idea, or you know, you obviously go with someone. If you can find someone that would actually share your interest and find a group, get connected with a group and travel, or even some buddies or whatever, and go out there photographing as a group, that's great. But often it is, I think, a bit of a lone pursuit in some respects, but not always. There's certainly more and more people interested in doing this kind of photography. So if you get into a group of some kind and some friends, and then you can have a lot more fun together.
Right, absolutely. All right, well, that's great. Thanks very much for this, Alan. Where is your website, and where can people see more of your work and ideas about nightscape imaging?
Well, the main website for me is AmazingSky.com, and that kind of is my central jumping-off point, but there's links there to all the social media spots where I am, Facebook and Twitter and Flickr and all that. And then there's a link there under a menu for blog as well. I have a blog where I post the more recent pictures and what's happening in the sky and alerts to things that might be worth photographing in the next few nights or days, as well on my blog. And there's a link off that main website to my blog as well. And there's links to Vimeo, where I have a channel there with some of the actual finished time-lapse movies as well. In fact, okay. I think one of those is posted on my AmazingSky.com website as well.
Okay, AmazingSky.com. So I'll put that in the show notes for sure, so everyone can find it. And also, Alan's 400-page multimedia ebook, which I mentioned before, is available for the iPad and Mac that's running the latest operating system at the iBookstore. Now, some people wonder why it's only for iPad and Mac, and that's because it's a multimedia book, so it's got galleries and video lessons built into it, things that you can't necessarily do on other platforms. And again, it's called Nightscapes and Time Lapses. So if you want to get into this art form, this is an excellent place to start, and it's worth every penny. So I'll put links to the book and also, as I said, to your website in the show notes. So, Alan, that's it for today. I want to thank you again for your patience and your time in getting this all set up.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's been a pleasure. And again, anybody has some questions, they can reach me through that website as well. There's email links there. And just let me know you're listening to your feed at Brian's site there, and that I know you heard it through this program.
Great. Thanks again, Alan. Take care and safe travels.
Thanks. Bye-bye.